she found the answer on that magic carpet ride last night. But when you wake up in the morning, the world still gets you uptight. Well, there's nothing better you ain't tried to fill the emptiness inside. When you come back down, girl, still ain't feeling right. Don't it seem like kids just keep getting harder to find, and all your kids ain't bringing you peace of mind. Before you find out it's too late, girl, you better get straight. No, but not with kicks. You just need help, girl. Well, you think you're gonna find yourself a little piece of paradise, but it ain't happened yet, so girl, you better think twice. Don't you see, no matter what you do, you'll never run away from you. And if you keep on running, you'll have to pay the price. And don't it seem like kicks just keep getting harder to find, and all your kicks ain't bringing you peace of mind. Before you find out it's too late, girl, you better get straight. No, you don't need kicks to help you face the world each day. That road goes nowhere. I'm gonna help you find yourself another way.
Kicks just keep getting hotter.
Oh,
to
you
find.
Don't
and
need kicks, girl.
You be so mad.
Just
before
need
you
help,
find
girl.
Out it's too late, girl. You better get straight.
And
don't it seem like kicks just keep getting hotter.
Oh,
to
you
find.
Don't
and
need
all
kicks,
kids,
girl.
Bad. Hello, everyone. This is Mitch Saunders coming to you with 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio, and this is the sixth installment of Swing Politics. Hope everyone is having a nice morning. Some of you commuting, some of you not up yet. Hoping I can give some information into what's going on in the political world, into your lives. And, I'm going to make sure all the microphones and forms are set up, and I'll be right on in just a few seconds. All right, thanks. Alright, hello again, and I'm ready to get started. So, what's going on in politics this week? What's been going on recently? Past 2 weeks, I guess, because I'm on the air every other week. And it's not like there's nothing to talk about. It's always something. So, I'd like to get started with discussing the debt ceiling, and not necessarily the specifics regarding the financial funding and paying off debts and the like, but more about sort of why the debt ceiling fight is important to both sides and what this means for elections and the party and their sort of face as they move forward, heading into elections in this November, even before that, which I'll get into a little bit later this hour. But also 2024. So effectively, what we're working with here is the debt ceiling is something that has to be increased. The timing, not exactly sure regarding the bills that fund the government, will eventually, for paying off debts globally, for paying off debts domestically, and for funding the government, the debt ceiling needs to be raised. Now, many economists, not many, I guess I would say a few, there's a lot of sort of speculation with what is going to happen, but many economists believe that if the debt ceiling fight continues in the way that it's going now, that the U.S. and the realistically the globe will see a recession that pales in comparison, or that the 2008 recession pales in comparison to, and that it would be absolutely devastating for the global economy and for individuals if a political game is played between House Republicans and Senate Democrats and President Biden. The Republicans have said that in their funding plans they want to cut Social Security, Medicare, welfare programs. Many of them have, not all of them, but they understand the toxicity of that, and ultimately they won't go through with that, from what I understand. But there is a big appetite to cut government spending when fiscal responsibility didn't really seem to be a problem when President Trump was in. And the $1.9 trillion stimulus act that they had just gave money to the wealthy, and Trump bloated the national debt three times what it was. Whereas President Biden has cut the debt, the national debt already, deficit. So The, I believe, from what I understand, is that the debt ceiling fight, the debt ceiling is fine through for the next few months. I think that's why the talks are happening now. I know the President Biden has met with McCarthy, with talks that apparently like could have been worse, which is, I guess, promising for a nation and a polarized nation that sort of never hears about the two parties having even remotely good conversations. But what does a government shutdown mean for both parties? The extent to which we feel it, the last time we had a government shutdown was in 2017. I believe it was the end of 2017 into 2018, under Trump. And that was when Trump's approval rating hit his lowest. It hit around, I think, 37-38% approval. And it recovered, and he sort of stayed at like the 41-42%. But every small percent of approval rating is a big deal because approval ratings are so static. But it was a really bad look for the Republicans when it happened in 2017. It was obviously the Republicans fully controlled the government at the time. So the fact that there was a debt ceiling showdown and government shutdown with unified Republican government was a little shocking, but also not, because Republicans have trouble unifying congressional majorities, as Kevin McCarthy is having that now. But I think that when you have a divided government and it were to shut down, I think the traditional ideology that I think Republicans are thinking is that it would go on Biden. And I don't think that that's necessarily wrong. People blame the guy in power. I do think that the 2022 midterm sort of demonstrated that there was a little bit of a heightened political knowledge that the population has. However, this is an electorate. 2022 midterm electorates are far more college educated, far more white. So, voters and individuals that don't have as much access to, you know, or don't have as much time to listen to political information, they're not going to get the truth of the matter. They're obviously not from Fox. Are they going to get that? Or, you know, any really real news source that it's, the headline would say, Republicans decide to not fund the government. Because the Senate could pass a funding bill, and the House would kill it. Realistically, Kevin McCarthy holds the cards to fund the government. I think that it would be sort of the same division along partisan lines regarding the reason, you know, regarding the failure to fund the government. I think that there would be a sect of people that would believe that, you know, this is the only difference is that there are Republicans in power now. And we'll have to wait and see, because I don't know if they'll end up coming to an agreement, but yeah, I'm not sure if Kevin McCarthy wants to have this as his first major action as Speaker is to, you know, shut down the government. That's what he wants to be remembered for, because that could alone remove him from the speakership, due to the fact that the House rules allow for one member to call for a motion to vacate the chair, which is vacating the speakership, and then requires a whole new election, a nomination series for Speaker of the House. Something that has been toyed with is that the executive branch could, because they have, I believe, the authority for minting currency, that the Treasury could mint a $1 trillion coin. That would be sort of quote unquote cashed, and would be used to pay off the debts or continue to fund the government. If it gets to a point where we are shut down for a while, I think Biden would have no problem pulling that trigger. Ultimately, the way that Republicans sort of lose in this instance is if the government does get shut down and Biden is the one that saves it, like solely Biden and nothing to do with the Republicans. I think that McCarthy does not want the debt ceiling he doesn't want the government to shut down. I think politically it's not good. It's not good for Biden, but it's equally not good for McCarthy. And, you know, everyone knows the House, Republicans hold the House now. So that's going to be an interesting showdown. I'm not entirely certain what's going to happen in that instance, how they're going to fund the government, what they're going to cut, because right now it just seems like a stalemate. So, what else has been going on? I guess we could talk about state legislatures a little bit. Some exciting news happened recently. Minnesota codified Roe, the state legislature, which recently became a Democratic trifecta, meaning they hold the state house, the state senate, and the governorship. Recently signed, Tim Walz is the governor of Minnesota. They recently signed into law this bill, which was a big deal. And for the first time since 2009, Democrats have, with three special elections in Pennsylvania, have gained control of the Pennsylvania House of Reps, the state house. So the Republicans, about 15 Republicans in the Pennsylvania State House, actually created a coalition with the Democrats to elect a moderate Democrat before these three special elections. So there already is a speaker that is a Democrat in the Pennsylvania House, but now they have an actual voting majority as well to pass legislation. Unfortunately, the Pennsylvania State Senate is held by Republicans. So, obviously, no legislation is going anywhere, but it is a an interesting development that Democrats would, you know, you'd never expect it in a incumbent Democratic midterm. You would gain, you know, a state house in a lopsided map with, you know, super competitive races that were won by, you know, handfuls of votes. So, hats off to the Pennsylvania Democrats for getting that done. And what's going on in special elections? Special elections and as well as regular elections, because there is no off year for politics. There's no off year for the campaign cycle. And although 2023 is not a big year, there are still a bunch of big races to focus on. So let's start with Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, there is, in April actually, not in November, this is the sort of major big race that is not being held in November. There are two elections that are really important. There is the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election. And the reason why this is so important is because the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin is currently made up of 7 members, and of those 7 members, 4 are conservatives and 3 are liberals. In 2020, Democrats flipped a seat, which made the 5-2 majority 4-3. And now a Republican justice is retiring, and Democrats have the opportunity to flip the seat and flip the court entirely. And the reason why that is so important is obviously for a lot of things. Controlling Supreme Courts is a great thing to be able to do. But what the sort of more important facet is that the Wisconsin maps are so gerrymandered that there's no world in which Democrats would ever be able to gain majorities in the state Senate or state House. And the congressional map is also gerrymandered in that Democrats are about 50% of the state, but they hold two of the eight congressional seats, whereas Republicans hold six of eight. Slopsided maps. Wisconsin effectively is not a democracy. It's crazy how, you know, sort of within a democratic country, you have a state that is completely and utterly Republican dictatorial. I mean, there's no worry that Republicans will ever lose their majorities. There is sort of no concern that Wisconsin could hand more seats to Democrats. It's sort of like, it's just like, you know, it's just a non-democratic state within a democratic country, which is a very, very weird dichotomy. And this state Supreme Court election, if the court ends up being controlled by liberals 4-3 with a flip in April, Democrats can undo, the Supreme Court can undo this gerrymander and force an independent drawer, force allow them to draw the map. There would be a lot of opportunities for Democrats to gain around two congressional seats and be competitive in the state legislature again for the first time since 2009. It also helps with other things like suing Republican legislation. Tony Evers is the governor of Wisconsin. He's a Democrat, and he is basically the only firewall to absolute Republican everything, banning abortion, right to work. Civil rights legislation, just rights in general legislation, economic bills, everything. Tony Evers is sort of the only stopgap to that. So, what does this mean for Democrats if they win this race, and who's running? Who's running for the seat? So there are four candidates. The way that the Wisconsin elections work is that later this month there'll be a primary, and the primary will take place as nonpartisan. So all candidates in the state Supreme Court are nonpartisan, even though they effectively do affiliate with party. In order to get fundraising and the like on the ballot, they show up as nonpartisan. There are four candidates running. There is Janet Protasiewicz. She is part of the Liberal Coalition. She is seems to be the front runner in terms of money. She's raised almost $1 million, which is extremely. I think it's blown out every other prior fundraising quarter for a state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, or possibly the entire nation. So her, her campaign seems to be doing very well with messaging as well as getting the money out, so hats off to her. There's another liberal running. His name is Everett Michael. Both of these are judges. Janet Protasiewicz is a judge in Milwaukee, in sort of suburban Milwaukee area. Everett Michael is also running. He's a liberal. He's also a judge. Not quite sure where he's from, but he is unlikely to win the primary. He only raised around $100,000. The liberals have seemed to coalesce around Protasiewicz, which is a great thing to do before the primary, because they know that going into the election, going into the general election, they will sort of know their person, know how to organize. They're building a name already, whereas on the Republican, on the conservative side, there's a bit of a split. So there are two judges. There is former state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly, who Kelly lost to I believe that was the election in 2020 with a candidate named Jill Karofsky, who ousted Justice Kelly, which was a very big deal. That was a flip. Justice Kelly is running again for this seat, and he raised around $300,000, a little over $300,000. And the same thing happened with, there's another judge, Jennifer Doro, who is on the, Waukesha, I believe it's the Waukesha, appellate court, something along those lines. And she also raised a little over $300,000. So those two are the conservatives running. And Doro has a lot of, at least recent political baggage. She came to sort of fame during a case that ultimately motivated her to run for the state Supreme Court, in that there was a... There was a major event. I think it was a Christmas Day parade or something like that. And there was an individual that, with their car, sort of hit a great deal of people, killed multiple people. I think it was like 18 people in this sort of driving through a parade, essentially. And the individual who did that sort of showed no remorse and was, you know, a rather, you know, pitiful human being. And it was Judge Doro that presided over that case, which caught the eye of the national media, CNN, Fox, MSNBC. And, you know, she said that she was crying during the ruling, because it was, to see someone have no remorse for doing something like that is, you know, a stain on humanity. And ultimately, there were people, even, she was such a sort of a figure in Wisconsin at the time, that children were dressing up as her for Halloween. So when she had that that opportunity, she sort of struck while the iron was hot. That was earlier last year when that happened. Earlier last year. And so she decided to run for state Supreme Court. And she has a lot of baggage. There's some things that she's done. She's worked for a law firm that has been notorious in sort of protecting sexual predators. She, I believe her son has, you know, dealt something like, there was a story about her, that her son was in the room with someone who overdosed. There's a lot of sort of questionable parts about the Doro family and sort of their past, and especially regarding Doro's law firm that you worked at before being nominated by Scott Walker to the appellate court in Waukesha. So the election's happening, the primary is happening on February 28th, from what I understand. It's going to be, again, all four candidates on one ballot, and then the top two will go to a runoff. It's likely that, it's almost certain, that Protasiewicz will win at least one of the top two spots, if not the top spot. And the other two conservatives will be fighting for second place. Justice Kelly has said that he will not endorse, he won't endorse Jennifer Doro for the state Supreme Court for the general election if she does get the nomination, if she does win the primary. So you could think why Democrats would honestly want to have Judge Doro be the nominee. Because if she is, then you have a sect of people that supported that are supporting Daniel Kelly that won't go for Doro. Most of them will. But if you're in a state with super tight elections, which is the case in Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, the senator that ran in 2022, only won by 1%. Evers won by 3%. Biden won the state by 0.2%. So... 0.6% actually in Wisconsin. So it's a hyper close state. And you need every vote you can get. Weirdly enough, in the last state Supreme Court election with Jill Karofsky, the margin was actually super wide. Karofsky ended up winning by like 10 points. So you sort of wonder what the salience of the candidate means, how they're sort of on the airwaves in Wisconsin. Relative to their opposition, how they compete. And Kurofsky obviously could compete well. Protezowitz seems to be good at raising money, and I'm sure she's on the air pretty constantly at this point. So we'll have to see how that shakes out and what that means going forward for April, and then what that means going forward for 2024 if the Liberals do win, redrawing House districts, redrawing the state legislature. And Liberals feel confident about the election given 2022. I think it's off year. You're going to have a motivated group of people that are going to vote. And college-educated white voters, especially, which are now aligned with the Democratic Party, is going to be a big pull for them. The other problem is that in Dane County and in Milwaukee County, you're going to have minority turnout be even lower than it was in November, which is always the case in non-general elections. Even in midterms, turnout is low. So that's going to be a very interesting race, and you're going to wonder how each side is going to sort of flip. It never quite follows ideological lines, these elections. Kurofsky won, you know, extremely Republican counties, so it's possible that whichever conservative judge ends up getting the nomination could end up winning, you know, the Green Bay area. Who knows? So. That's going to be an interesting election to see how it shakes out. But also on the very same day in April, there is a state Senate election. And that is sort of small. If there was a state Senate election in any other state, it would kind of not be a big deal. But because we're working with super majorities of Republicans in Wisconsin, it kind of is a big deal. Because Republicans hold 21 of 33 seats in the state Senate. There's one vacancy, and that one vacancy is this open state Senate seat. So, if Republicans end up winning the seat, they hold 22 of 33 seats, and they hold supermajorities in the state Senate. Obviously, this is not Democratic because it's Wisconsin, and we know that it's a 50-50 state. But if Republicans win this, then they can override the governor's veto, which is a very big deal. Now, they don't have the majority in the House. They only have 64 of 99 seats, and 64 of 99 is 65%. So they would need one more seat in the state assembly to override the governor's vote in. Fully. They obviously can't override his vote on anything the state legislature fully has control over, like essentially legislation. But for anything in the state constitution that is solely relegated to the state Senate, if they hold this state Senate seat, this open state Senate seat, then they can override the governor's veto or override the decision that he makes. And that's a big deal. I believe the seat was held by a Democrat. I believe it's a very competitive seat. Governor Evers put that election on the same day as the state Supreme Court election. To try to drum up turnout. Because if you have that on a random Tuesday sometime, it's just, you're not going to have turnout for it. So at least the state Supreme Court election will sort of give a little down ballot support. So that's what's going on in Wisconsin in April, and there's going to be periodic updates of that every time I'm on the air, especially after the primary. So what other elections are going on this year then? We've got a few big ones. I'd say the three biggest elections, two of them take place in Virginia and one of them takes place in Kentucky. So, Virginia has its House of Delegates, which is basically the state house, and its state Senate having elections in 2023. Now, in 2021, which was sort of the peak of the red wave with inflation super high, Democrats held the House 55, 45 before 2021, and afterwards, Republicans held it 51-49. They gained the chamber, 51-49. Democrats had gained the chamber in 2019 for the first time in over a decade. That was during the blue wave leading up to 2020. And Republicans in 2021, it was just the House of Delegates that was up for election, not the state Senate. But of course, they also flipped the governorship. Glenn Youngkin won over Terry McAuliffe, who was the former governor in 2013 to 2017. So, if Republicans have a good year in 2023, this year, it's a weird thing to say, if they have a good cycle, like they did in 2021, they could likely gain the state Senate. And if they gain the state Senate, then they hold a trifecta, and they would hold a Republican trifecta in a Biden plus 10 state, which is pretty wild, because Virginia is not it's not a red state, it's not a purple state either, it's a blue state. It's been a blue state since Obama won it in 2012. And especially with the educational and, with the educational realignment, and the, geographic realignment of the suburbs, it's solidified itself as that Democratic state. And it will, continue to trend in that direction, given the expanding, Northern Virginia area, like Fairfax, Arlington, Alexandria, the like. So, Democrats are hoping they can regain the House of Delegates. They only need to flip two seats to regain control of the chamber. And a lot of the seats are in competitive areas. They're, single-digit Trump or single-digit Biden districts, and in the Virginia State Senate, Democrats hold the chamber 21-19. So the state Senate only has elections every 4 years. So in 2019, they gained 21-19. They hold that now. And if Republicans were to gain a trifecta, they would likely pass an abortion limiting bill that Glenn Youngkin, the governor, has supported. It was killed by the state Senate. Democrats actually don't hold 21-19. They actually hold 22-18 majority. And the reason why is because there was a special election a few weeks ago that had Aaron Rouse, who is a former NFL player, win the state Senate district that was held by Jen Kiggins. Jen Kiggins is currently the representative for the Virginia Beach District. I believe it's Virginia 2. Kiggins kicked out Elaine Luria, who was elected in 2018 and reelected in 2020, but could not hold on in this Biden plus 3 seat in the 2022 elections. And so Jen Kiggins, who was the state senator at the time, then became the congressional representative, and then that district became vacant, the state Senate district. So they had to have a special election for that. And this, the state Senate district is interesting because Kiggins won it even though it was Biden plus 10 in 2019. So it was a sort of traditionally Republican district that is more and more moving towards the Democrats. And because of that, you have this sort of down ballot effect that makes people vote for Republicans, for Democrats, for president and Senate, but they would still vote for Republicans at the state legislature level. So the lower you get on the ballot, the likelier have a Republican incumbent in a Republican traditionally Democratic trending area. Kiggins was that. She represented the district for a long time, and they knew her, and in the somewhat competitive district, she was able to retain that support to be reelected. And Democrats ended up flipping the district. They won it by about 1 or 2 points, which was a big deal because it was a flip. and, you know, incumbent, you know, during Democratic years for presidential, during a Democratic president, you know, Republicans are supposed to perform better in special elections. And I think my theory on that is that because you have a more motivated electorate, you have a more educated electorate on the Democratic side that used to be on the Republicans a decade ago. But because you have that, you're able to turn out your voters more than low propensity, not educated, not following the news voters. And Republicans have sort of taken more of those voters into their coalitions since the Obama era. So that flip left Democrats at 22-18. And this is important because there's a state senator by the name of Joe Morrissey. Joe Morrissey is kind of a whack job. He is a Democrat, but he's also a fan of a lot of gun rights legislation. And he's even, you know, he's sort of like in the middle on abortion, where he supports some limitations, something like that. And there are a lot of states that have limitations on abortions late term, but I believe it's a right in the Virginia Constitution or something along those lines, with legislation that was passed that sort of allows for abortion rights in the state. And Youngkin wanted to limit it to, I believe, 15 weeks or... I believe it was 15 weeks, sort of a more moderate of the bans, but still something that Senate Democrats didn't support, but Joe Morrissey might have. And with this new Democratic, Democrat elected, now the state Senate is 22-18 for the Democrats, they are more likely to hold the chamber going into 2020, going into this election cycle, as well as that abortion ban doesn't have a chance of passing. So that was a big win for Democrats, and I would guess that Democrats would regain the House of Delegates chamber if the elections were held right now. I believe they would regain the House of Delegates. So it would be Democratic State House and State Senate, and then a Republican governor, and he's up for... he's actually not up for re-election. In Virginia, they are the only state where you can have a governor run for one term, and they can run for another term, but it has to be non-consecutive. So Terry McAuliffe was the governor from 2013 to 2017, and then he ran for the governorship again in 2021. He ultimately lost to Glenn Youngkin, but it is possible that you are elected for a term and then you are not there, obviously, because in the state constitution you can hold as many terms as you want as long as they're not consecutive, and then come back for another term after someone else's governorship. And then the third sort of interesting election that's taking place, the competitive one, is in Kentucky. You wouldn't expect Kentucky to have, competitive elections. Trump won the state by 30. It's where Mitch McConnell's from. Republicans have a grapple hold on the state legislature. It's one of those southern states. Interesting fun fact, the Democrats actually held the Kentucky State House until 2016. So if you ever want to, you know, talk about down ballot lag, Republicans sort of doing better in traditionally Democratic places, and so Democrats would elect down the ballot, but Republicans would be winning the presidential and Senate level. It's the opposite in the case for Kentucky, where you still have to this day, Democrats performing better on the state legislature level because it's down ballot. And because it's down ballot, sort of it's less salient, and people just sort of often go with the incumbent. This was the case with Rhode Island. Rhode Island had a lot of liberal Democrats and some liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats for quite a while, the 90s and 2000s. And so, you know, places that would vote for Clinton by double digits would also vote for Republican state legislators by double digits. So in Kentucky, we have the governor's race that is extremely competitive. It is, the incumbent is a Democrat, actually. He won in 2019. His name is Andy Beshear. He was the attorney general of the state prior to being elected, and he is the son of Steve Beshear, and Steve Beshear was a former governor in the 2000s, I believe, 2000 to 2010, somewhere in that region. In 2019, Beshear kicked out the incumbent governor, Andy Bevin. Bevin was extremely controversial in a lot of his opinions on education and not really abortion. It was mostly just sort of things that he did that were sort of over the top. He was a hardcore Republican that sort of didn't even align with values that the even Republican Party holds sacred, which is not very many. So Beshear ended up winning that race by 0.4%. He didn't even win a majority. It was 49.2% to 48.8%. And Beshear winning that was a really big deal, because, you know, you wouldn't expect that Democrats would flip a governorship in, you know, in the South like that, in a very non-competitive, state normally. And so he has, in the past been able to stop Republican legislation. Republicans hold supermajorities now in the state Senate and state governorship and then state House. So, his veto is not, powerful really in very many ways, but, he seems to be really well liked by, Kentuckians. His approval ratings are really high, like plus 15 or something like that. For a Democratic governor in a Republican state, it's pretty crazy. But also, when Republicans give Democrats a chance in states, they tend to sort of like them in some ways. And the elections are still competitive to reelect them, but they're still approved of. John Bel Edwards in the South, governor of Louisiana, is also highly approved. He's well-liked by his people. And he also is pro-life, but he's also a Democrat. And so in Louisiana, you kind of take what you can get nowadays for the Democrats. So Beshear is going to be running, from what I understand, against, I believe, Daniel Cameron, who is the Attorney General. He is Republican. He is the first black Attorney General in the state. And he was sort of a Mitch McConnell protege. He is likely running for the governorship, and it's going to be a really, really competitive election. I think that the fundamentals would tell you that Republicans are likely to win it. I'm not so sure. I think that if I were to lean one way, I would lean towards the Republicans winning it, but also kicking out a highly popular incumbent Democratic governor, or a highly popular incumbent governor, is a really difficult thing to do. I think that there is, something to be said for Beshear's popularity, and that there might be a bit of a messy primary. I think that there will be a bunch of people jumping in the race. I think Daniel Cameron is probably the front runner, but also you will probably see Beshear's favorables and approvals drop heading into November, given all of the negative media that will sort of be spotlighted on Beshear. You're going to have Republicans try their best to kick them out because it should be an easy layup. And if his favorables are brought down, then there's really nothing that's boosting Bashir's candidacy other than his incumbency. So it's looking to be a competitive election in November for that, to see if Democrats will hold on to that for the next 4 years or if Republicans will regain the trifecta. And there's also a few elections that are not so competitive but are good for benchmarks going into 2024, seeing what the populace is like. In 2022, Democrats did a really good job at persuasion. Their whole thing was that they were able to sort of outperform what the popular vote had handed them. So, essentially, Republicans ended up winning the popular vote adjusted by about 1 point, 1.5 points, but Democrats almost won the House without necessarily winning the popular vote, which is crazy. But it also means that their electoral coalition was so efficient in that they found the votes in all the right seats, in the right numbers, in the right places. And that was because of their persuasion, especially of shockingly non-college educated voters. And turnout in young voters and turnout in the groups that they needed, even while still losing the House. So it was a very good midterm for them, as I've gone over in prior prior episodes. So the things that are going to give some information in 2024, on top of the Virginia and Kentucky races, is the New Jersey State Senate and State House of Representatives that are holding their elections. There will be a bunch of competitive districts. Republicans gained in 2021. They had a very close governorship race in the state. The Democrat only won by 3% in like a Biden plus 15, 20 state. And they gained in the state legislature. They actually kicked out the state Senate president, who had been there forever. His name was Steve Sweeney, and he lost to a Republican who raised $153, and he was just a truck driver. Kicked him out, which is pretty crazy, that that's sort of how polarization takes you. But also, weirdly enough, Democrats were very happy that Sweeney was removed and lost the position, because he was sort of notorious for blocking legislation that was more liberal and progressive. So it was sort of, for the at least the Democrats in New Jersey, a good riddance. You know, maybe they lost the battle, but they won the war in that case. So I have a feeling the Democrats will be gaining a few seats in the state legislature in New Jersey, and that will sort of tell us what 2024 looks like. And then you also have two more governor's races that are interesting, but not going to be super competitive from what I understand. You have Louisiana, which has an incumbent Democratic governor, as I mentioned. His name is John Bel Edwards. He was elected in 2015 in the Obama era, and then reelected in 2019, both by very small margins. But winning margins nonetheless. Bel Edwards is, obviously he has two terms and he is retiring because he is term limited, and Republicans will flip this seat. They'll regain control of their trifecta, and, you know, that'll be that for Democrats in Louisiana, at least for a little bit. And then you have Mississippi. Mississippi has their governor's race. And the incumbent governor is Tate Reeves. Now, there has been a lot of problems with Reeves as governor. He has I'm sure people have heard of the Jackson water crisis, that there's been that Jackson, which is a majority African-American town, had not had clean water for many months, and I still think it's unsafe to drink the water there. And that's sort of all on Tate Reeves and his administration. His governorship has been poor for Republicans and Democrats alike in the state. Mississippi is one of the worst states for education, for healthcare, for economics, for population growth, everything. It's a really, really unfortunate hand that they've been dealt, and unfortunately that they've elected people that don't care about those things and don't seek to improve them as much as they sort of posture to. And there's a really interesting Democrat that's running for that election that might make it closer than normal, even if Republicans do win. And his name is Brandon Presley. He's a Democrat from a super Republican not district. He's a part of a it's a statewide, elected region that deals with, specific counties regarding issues they might have administratively. And there are four districts and it's sort of the northern part of Mississippi, which is super rural, super Republican, and it's represented by a Democrat who's represented it for a while. It's the Mississippi, just looking it up now, it's the Mississippi Public Service Commission. So he was elected since 2008. And he continues to hold this seat, and apparently people seem to like him. Republicans like him, Democrats like him. So him running for this seat, I think he's conservative because he represents a really conservative area, but him running for this seat might make it a little bit more competitive. I think that Reeves is likely to win, but the fact that Reeves has sort of been effectively not there. I don't know if you heard that car honking, but... yeah, that's what the people of Mississippi feel about Tate Reeves. I think that that's a really interesting election that's going to come about. And it was a close one in 2019. It was around a six-point election, which shouldn't be the case. But that was also during the height of the Trump, Democratic backlash against the Trump administration, the Trump elections. So... I was going to get to the presidential primary calendar for 2024, which is going to be changed by Democrats. I guess I'll be talking about that next time. But I can sort of give you a sneak peek in that Democrats have voted, at least the National Committee voted, to change their state primary order. So the old states were the Iowa caucuses, the New Hampshire primary, the Nevada caucuses, and then the South Carolina primary. And to change it to South Carolina first, to Nevada and New Hampshire on the same day, then Georgia, and then Michigan, which would be a big change, but also something that would give more power to African-American voters, especially with South Carolina and Georgia, as well as the Rust Belt with Michigan and Nevada for especially Latino voters. So I can get into sort of the importance of that and what those new states might mean. I believe they have to be approved by the states themselves, though, and that seems super unlikely to happen. So I'm not quite sure how the process goes with changing the primary calendar because it's not a unilateral decision by the Democratic National Committee. So I think that might be it for today. Thank you for listening to Swing Politics with Mitch Saunders. My DJ name is Big Mitch. And I hope that you guys continue to follow your politics for the week. I know I will. And I'll be sure to, get back at you with what's important in the next 2 weeks. And Jake, thanks for listening along. All right. Have a good rest of your day, everyone.